Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today we are going to play part two of our interview with Sasha Stone. We were diving really deep into the international human trafficking trade of children and the satanic abuse. And so we're going to continue that interview now, and you can hear, if you missed the first part, go to my website, sarahwestall.com, and you can get the first part of this interview there. Otherwise, it's up on YouTube. It's up everywhere. So you should be able to subscribe and get my shows. So let's play the second part of my interview with Sasha Stone.
And right or wrong no longer plays a part in the equation. So morality is completely gone through this myopic worldview. And the absence of empathy is now completely entrained into the population who are doing the attacking and doing the violations of natural law. And after Syria, of course, it is Iran, which is end game. So Syria and North Korea were always intended to be dreamt up as the bogeymen in Southeast Asia and the Middle East, in order to foment a full-on, full battle between Iran and Israel, which is to say Iran and the United States of America and its allies. And that is where you see the Huntingtonian clash of civilizations being manifested, engineered from within the basement of the Pentagon, of Washington, of Whitehall, and of Brussels. And that is intended, of course, as part of a greater Zionist narrative, which is to also bring about essentially this proverbial World War III, which to anyone who has any nous knows full well, World War III has been upon us for some time. It was always intended to be a psychological war principally, but ultimately it is also designed to bring about catastrophic failure of social ecology and the social economy of the planet, so that out of the ashes of that pandemonium, engineered pandemonium, will emerge a new world order, the one that the grisly Bush Senior spoke about many years ago.
Well, you know, it always amazes me, you know, when Madeleine Albright talked about, she was asked point blank whether the 500,000 children and parents that were murdered or killed in the war, whether that was worth it. And she thought it was worth it. But yet we attack and we smear a leader supposedly for killing 100 people with gas, which we all know it was the story is incredibly suspicious. But we can say that killing, you know, millions of people is worth it, while we are pointing our finger at somebody for killing 100 people. And the week after those 100 people were killed, there were even more people killed by our forces.
You know, we get into such inverted logic here. I'll be blunt with you. It's not even worth speaking to us because it's so grotesquely insulting to any intelligence. But you're absolutely right, of course. That is the dystopia, the engineered dystopia, and the complete malfunction of morality and the absence of empathy that I was speaking about. That's the new hybridized civilizational complex. It's just at a complete loss as to what is right or wrong or up or down. This is called helter-skelter. This is a language that brings great delight and joy to the, you know, what I would coin the Babylonian priests who are still governing from behind the veil, albeit on the back foot. I'm certainly of the view that the Saturnian interests are on the decline and on the back foot, and that the battle, in a sense, has already been won. I'm personally not that worried about a conflagration taking place in the Middle East and a world war breaking out and, you know, a return to the throne of Solomon and all that grisly stuff. I don't believe we're going into that space. I believe that timeline is no longer an option, that we've already overcome essentially the very worst of what it was in the basement, psychologically speaking, which again is why things like judicial commissions of inquiry and truth and reconciliation commissions and rapprochement, communicating and truth saying and shedding light, which can only happen if we walk in a straight line, if we anchor ourselves in truth and don't couch our language. And more than anything, do not root our lives or our expression in fear and fearfulness, because that is the gravest crime of all, is for me to be sitting in my home in a state of fear, which paralyzes my capacity to do right action in this world. And that absence of right action equates to people being butchered on the streets and in foreign lands without me standing up and speaking about it. And of course, ultimately, there's a knock on my door and they come for me too. And there's no one left to defend me.
So when we look at the big picture here, who are the people that are really pushing for this global empire? And you're saying it's a bloodline, but it's really a group of people who have the most money in this world, right? And who, of those people who are the most powerful, because there's some people who have money, probably aren't as sucked into it. So what, who are these people?
I'm not the man to point and say it's X, Y, and Z. I've got a very clear idea in my own mind of X, Y, and Z. But it's just not, I'm not the one to be naming names. I'm not that kind of a researcher. I know what I've learned and what's been taught to me and told to me by members of those very ranks. So I'm fairly certain in my own mind. One only needs to look very closely at the shareholders, the owners of the Federal Reserve banks in the United States. One only needs to look at the owners and stakeholders of the parent corporation. Look at the powers behind the Vatican interests and so on, and you start to build up a very keen pathology of who's who and what's what. Most of the people who are in power in the world at the tip of the pyramid, they are not evil, and they are not even aware sometimes of what's going on in the basement. But there is a separation between the capstone of that pyramid and the body politic, and there is an intercessionary level there, and that is where, by and large, the priesthood that I'm referring to harbors themselves and acts as a disconnect between the leadership and the body politic. So the leadership is driven in a particular way, and the body politic is saying, hey, we want to go in that direction, but the leadership is driving in that direction, and there's a disconnect, and it's the intercessionary or the priesthood that stands between the two that is doing the subverting. And who are the agents of subversion? There are more of them, one imagines, than you and I would care to imagine. That much I've certainly learned from the films I've made on Satanism and on generational Satanism and on how many practicing Satanists, for instance, are purported to exist in the United States of America alone. If you knew the demographic, it is staggering.
So what is that number? Do we have what those numbers are?
The very best, most informed opinions that we've received from people in those ranks themselves, whistleblowers and survivors of ritual Satanism, generational Satanism, it's anywhere between 9% and 11% of the entire population.
Oh, that's pretty significant. And they hide it because they can't go forward with it in light in the public because people wouldn't accept it. So do they know it's bad, or they just...
They do bring it out into the public domain. It's thrown in our face. It's called Eyes Wide Shut. It's what makes Beyoncé and Jay-Z and so many of these luminaries in Hollywood and in the music scene so incredibly popular. They are couched in the language of Satanism, of Canaanite ritualism, of Baphomet, of Moloch, of all of this nonsense. The paraphernalia, the costumery, the symbolism, is everywhere in mainstream entertainment, for instance, in sporting events, in NFL and the biggest sporting events in around the world, the Olympics ceremonies, the ceremonial opening up of tunnels and of big buildings, invariably at a certain level contain also the symbolism well known, well understood to those who have the trained eye. Mm-hmm. I mean, if anyone interested in this particular subject, I would suggest brush up on Mark Passio and Jay Parker, some extraordinary brains out there and people who know a great deal more than I do.
But they have to couch it in symbols and language that the masses don't connect with. They don't come out and say, you know, we're Cygnus.
Look, it's like this. I'm going to try and patchwork something for you here. You mentioned earlier about, you know, babies being killed, for instance, and it's impossible to understand the logic or the rationale for somebody wanting to drink the blood of an innocent infant and then ritualistically kill the infant. But you see, at a different level, coming at it from a completely different perspective, the individual doing the culling knows that that may not know, but that the infant at the soul level is offering itself up for sacrifice. Everything happens because it is intended to happen. Nothing is happenstance. So there are compacts and covenants at the soul level that you and I are making, which bring about all sorts of events in our lives, some of them horrendous, that we can't compute with the temporal brain, but have a very, very different resonance and understanding in the transmigration of the soul from life to life, from form to form. So if one looks at it in a different way and understands that the infant being sacrificed in a particular ritual has covenanted at the soul level to be in that time and place, and is indeed devoured by some diabolical entity, but that is the seeding of light inside that diabolical entity. And at a very, very high level, and I mean a real supernatural level, that seeding is the absolution principle, the seeding of light into the heart of darkness, which will ultimately turn that dark entity on its own trajectory and bring it towards the light. It will go through the fires of hell to get to the light, but at least that seeding has taken place. So you see, if you really step back from this temporal world and try to see it from a very heightened spiritual, non-identifying perspective, there are different principles at work that are very hard for you and I to understand, because you and I are feet on the ground, psychologically reflexive, emotionally entrained, and we are essentially based on fight or flight principles. But there are different, far more subtle and far more intelligent processes taking place in the exchange, even in ritual Satanism, that are known at the soul level to both entities, but not necessarily in the temporal sense.
Well, Regina Grimes, do you know who she is?
No.
Okay, well, she's been studying this for a long time and talking about afterlife and what the souls are making decisions and things. And I'm assuming that's kind of where you're coming from. Where have you gotten your knowledge when it comes to what happens at the soul level? I mean, where can people learn more about this, and how do you come to that conclusion?
Because I was the creature you're describing. I was the man who was so profoundly injured and offended by reality. As I began to see, I grew up in a war in Africa first. I was stateless for 10 years without a passport. I was butchered to submission by states and the fictions of governments and states. And I then got into rock and roll and did my kind of primal scream thing. And I then purposed my life at a given point. I wanted to just break out of the fallacy of rock and roll, of entertainment, and I purposed myself toward my soul's leaning, which was identification not with false light, but really investigating reality, real reality, and immersing myself in that place. And I went around the world for many, many years. This is well documented, and met with countless leaders in all, you know, spiritual disciplines, in religions, faiths, governments, all around the world. And I conducted the conversations as a living man. And I went on foot to do that. So I've been to very remote places and met extraordinary people, and I've had the conversations. And on that journey, I was informed variously by, sometimes by leaders themselves, who patronized me and said, well, you need to know this, that this is how the world works. So I stopped being so idealistic when I was about 35 years old. And I started to go, hang on, it's not just about, you know, bringing the Jews and the Muslims together and the Christians together at a meeting in the United Nations to try and get them to, you know, roll up their sleeves. There is no possibility of them rolling up their sleeves and finding any kind of peace, because that bishop will be removed from office long before his initiative gets ratified. And that president who wants to make peace with that president has only got 2 years left in his democratic tenure, and he's only got 3 years left. So I began to learn that democracy itself, for instance, is designed to prevent any change. So you vote a prime minister or president in, he's got 4 years to make the changes. He spends the first 3 years defending himself from attack on all sides, and the last year getting ready to transition power and create some kind of legacy. But invariably, the great dreams that he harbored or she harbored will not be able to take root. And I've studied this over so many years, over 20 years now, and I've been talking to presidents and kings and bishops and ministers for that period of time, for 18, 19 years. So I have a lot of experience in firsthand feedback. And I began to build up this kind of holonomic pathology of how fucked up we really are and why. Because then I wanted to know why, who's behind that engine, this engineering. And then it starts to emerge. When one casts light upon any subject by placing one's attention on it, you literally enlighten something, and the photons stream through your consciousness onto the subject if your inquiry is honorable and done in truth. Then the answer becomes known. Your instinct, your psionic intelligence, your intuitive logic starts to emerge. That becomes the language that informs and builds up. You know, it's rather like when you're trying to see those 3D glasses, you have to have a red and a blue or whatever it is, two separate fields that have to morph together to create the focus. It's very much the same thing, where you can have informed wisdom, but it will not tell you the story. Your intuitive logic that you've also picked up by standing in that flame of pure truth will come to bear, and the fusion of those two will go eureka. Now you see the hologram. You can walk around it, you can touch it, you can cross-reference it, and you begin to see that this is the emergent so-called truth or the reality of a given subject. And then the question becomes, what are you going to do about it? Are you going to simply see it and then retire to your library and write memoirs when it's safe to do so? Or are you going to kick the goddamn door down and walk in to that space? And many good people of the world are doing that right now, are choosing dynamic consciousness in action in order to face down the underbelly of who and what we are as a civilization, because that is how we bring about the transmutation into the other.
Do you think your childhood and your really difficult times that you had growing up was intentional so that you could be where you are now?
Of course. I mean, I call it the meta geometry, or I call it meta psychogeometry, which is where what I was inviting earlier, when one learns to stand back, even off planet, literally, astrally, remove yourself into the higher regions of the atmosphere, look down, so to speak, on the earth, and recognize the interconnectedness of all things and the fallacy of time and the fallacy of space, and then recognize that everything is divinely appointed, so to speak. And when one recognizes that everything in the now is divinely appointed, then one cannot but find peace with it. More or less, one finds peace with it. That's not to say you're not going to have a lot of shitty things to deal with in life still on a daily basis. That's almost certainly going to continue. But then the way that one views it and can navigate through turbulence becomes all important. So yes, I recognize that whatever hardships I may have suffered pale into insignificance by comparison with millions and millions of other souls. But certainly for me, for the soul expression that I represent in this temporal plane, my life was designed to burn me, to absolutely, you know, burn me to the maximum at a given point. And that is where the fulmination of expression emerges anyway, if we survive that that offensive without resorting to our normal reflexes, which invite us to getting into addictions, into alcohol, or into drugs, or into sex, or into, you know, false light worship, iconoclasticism, which most people, incidentally, in most cities are simply addicted to that. They are so involved in latter-day idolatry or iconoclasticism, so they busy themselves up with trips to the cinema or to cocktail parties or to museums or to whatever, anything, or listening to music all day long on their goddamn earphones, anything but engage the stillness, anything but engage the mirror pool of the silence within, which always reveals and reflects our perfect reflection to ourselves. And that's the only way we can transcend that pain ultimately, is by sitting with it and seeing that reflection, and more than that, embracing that reflection. I remember the day, the minute I did it for myself was in the 1st of August 1997, and I remember the instant that I actually stopped running and I owned myself and I stood in my skin and the flame emerged and I looked in the mirror, the inner mirror. And then I went to find a real mirror in my living room. And I found when I looked and I could see myself in a mirror, looking at myself in the inner mirror. And I went, I am, this is me. And this is now. And there is nothing outside of this. And there's nothing more important than this moment now. And this moment now must always be a living moment. Time is not the equation. Space is not the equation. Money is not the equation. And so fearlessness becomes the natural quanta that emerges from being able to see oneself fully, forgive oneself, and then own one's life stream. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. And it doesn't require a priest. It doesn't require a doctor or a lawyer or a bank manager. It's beautiful.
Or a bank manager. So if everything is meant to be, okay, I'm going to ask you kind of a question that is paradoxical. If everything is meant to be, then it almost becomes lethargic. I mean, we need to still fight to change. You know what I'm asking?
I do know what you're asking, but you're asking a quantum question from a linear perspective, so you will not hear the answer unless you step outside of that position.
Okay.
So, and one could answer it. Look, there is an infinite iterations or extrapolations of now. So the now that I am sitting in is one to a billion to the tune of billions of nows. This is not the issue. It's not a numerical thing. It's just about the flame of pure truth that I refer to has another name, and I would refer to it as isness. Just the business of being here now and cohering or fusing the being and the doing into one. I've spoken about this in multiple venues. But when what we be and what we do become the same quanta, this is the Christ, this is the Buddha, this is the Bodhisattva, this is the awakening, this is the great moment. The phoenix arises from that moment when our being and our doing become the same. And I speak to it in terms of the being speaks to anchoring, you know, in the vertical plane, and the doing speaks, which is space, And the doing speaks to time, the horizontal plane. So when that axis is met and fuses perfectly and being and doing become the same thing, then we're no longer chasing our tail. We're no longer running from something in life because we're afraid to look back, or we were so hurt that we need to get away from it. And we're not running towards something because we're addicted towards false light, or because we're in love with an idea that may or may not exist over the horizon. We stop all of that nonsense. And we recognize that running from and running toward is the same thing. It is escaping the now. And the now is the only place we're going to find true refuge and true enlightenment, so to speak. And with that emancipation comes fearlessness. And with the absence of fear, and this is the answer to your question, and with the absence of fear comes actualized consciousness. And actualized consciousness is so creative, you cannot believe it. So you take on the prana, the life force streams through you, and you're able to do things and be things because you're now doing them as one. And it becomes, you can do so much more, so much creatively. And when you envision things, they tend to manifest in record time. There's little effort because the being and the doing have gone into that serendipity point, that bliss point. And you're becoming an agent of immanence, an agent of divinity, a son or a daughter of God, so to speak. It's what we all are training ourselves towards through our various spiritual and religious disciplines, but they are always being interceded with and interposed with by false morality and by rules and regulations and gospels and doctrine and dogma. And what we want to do is step outside of all of that nonsense and simply actualize. And then look around and go, what do I want to manifest in this world? How can I make the change? How can I beautify this world? How can I enlighten this world? And then go forth and do it.
So does everyone have a different, when you reach that epoch, when you're connected completely, does everybody have different roles to play? But is it all towards the goal of enlightenment?
This is the beauty. We all have the same role to play, but the expressions are multifarious. But it is the same. It is the anchoring of pure truth in the now, which ultimately, once enough are doing it on the surface of the plane of the earth, once enough actualized souls have reconnected that quanta to source, so to speak, that activates a far greater flame of becoming, known loosely as the noosphere, which is the actualizing of the planetary consciousness or so-called Gaia consciousness. And that then is what we can steer an entire species into a higher evolutionary expression. And that's precisely where we are at the meta planetary level. We are at that threshold of that collective unfoldment or flashpoint of awakening, where we are able to then collectively cohere into a unified field of creative intelligence, which will then steer our entire field of expression of the entire earth plane into a higher incarnation or a higher expression. And that's happening. So it's not as though that's some kind of spiritual prophecy or prognosis. It's happening already for those who have the eyes to see. But those, conversely, who don't have the eyes to see, they are seeing apocalypse. They're seeing catastrophic failure. They're seeing Armageddon. And that's the beauty of the alchemical bifurcation that occurs always at the closure of a cycle and the emergence of a new. That the those who have attuned themselves and chosen, elected at the soul level to resonate to certain frequencies, which I would describe as frequency X and below, they will attune into a field which is commensurate with the old forms, the old arcane expression, which is absolutely undergoing Armageddon and apocalypse. So that's what they will behold and experience. But those who have already cohered by choice to frequency X and above, which I would describe as the heart frequency and above, will similarly, or in the other sense, will cohere into a very, very different evolutionary upgrade and begin to see the beauty in everything. Even, as I said, beginning to see, I wouldn't say the beauty in ritual sacrifice or the beauty in pedophilia or the beauty in of course, one can't speak in those terms, but to begin to see the geometry. That's why I use the term meta-psychogeometry of what's going on. That's a language which, if we attune ourselves to our higher intelligence, we begin to make peace with the fact that there is a higher logic unfolding, and it's not just haphazard, which was when I was in my teens and my 20s, I hated this world. I couldn't bear this world. I was a poet at the time. And I could just about escape into poetry from the horrors, A, of what I was running away from, my childhood in the war-torn Africa, and, you know, being torn off my mother's tit for far too long, all of that stuff, I was running from it. And I escaped into poetry, and I was so offended and so injured at the soul level by reality, by bloodletting, by all, and I didn't even know about Satanism at that time. I didn't even know about the invisible stuff. I was just talking to, you know, crackheads and punch-ups and ugly human behavior and exploitation, you know. And I found that so injurious. But again, now I see those same grotesqueries unfold, but I'm not identifying with them. So therefore, I'm not viscerally attached with this reflexive emotionalism, which prohibits me from understanding anything, which is why we have to begin to transcend and transmute those emotional reflexes, psychological reflexes to life, because they don't serve. They don't serve the other, and they don't serve you. They actually maintain the status quo.
So now that you're connected, you really feel like you've gotten to this other point. Do you believe that your whole, everything you are is to change this world and to get everyone you possibly can up to that level?
Absolutely not. And if ever that was my impetus, I would ask you to take me around the back and beat me around the back of the head with a lead pipe. No, I am not interested in that. And I don't believe it is my mandate or your mandate or anyone's mandate to go and teach others in that sense. I understand the noble intention of what you just said. But again, for me, it becomes injurious because that is what we've been doing to each other historically. We've been inveigling, enchanting, manipulating and mind-fucking one another into each other's idiom. And when that doesn't work, we've become aggressive and ended up punching each other up, and that's led to full-on battles and wars. And so that's not the way to go. What the business of just being in one's own skin and owning one's own expression and participating in one's own enfoldment, knowing that if one is attuned to that higher logic and that anchored in spiritual unfoldment, then you are naturally going to radiate energetics, subtle energetics and frequencies, so to speak, that will serve the greater unfoldment, that will absolutely help others to attune. Because the more a positive tone augments another positive tone, it creates an overtone. The overtone is enchanting, and that in itself enchants ever more to it. So that's the symphony that is unfolding by natural law. We don't need to orchestrate it ourselves. Sasha Stone will not, must not go and try and orchestrate that. But to answer your question, and I was coming around to it, yes, I go forth every day seeking absolutely to deploy the application of art, the application of beauty, and the application of consciousness into the field, because it serves truth and it serves unfoldment, and it always delivers a higher outcome. Always.
So it's important how you go about doing it. It's being true to yourself and doing what you need to do and bringing beauty into the world and the truth into the world, but not forcing that down someone else's throat or trying to manipulate someone else to be that way, because that doesn't work.
Yes, but I will say that when I began my peacenik journey, I was that kid. I was that young man going, I'm going to change the world. I'm going to do everything I can. And I wanted to. And I, because I wanted to stop hiding in poetry, in, you know, and music, I wanted to come out punching and change the world. But it took me, I think, 5, 6, or 7 years. I can't remember. Something like that, to give up the ghost on that and think, this is folly, man. This is really folly. And you're going to have to become the man. Stop looking for the man. Become the man. And when I stepped into my skin fully, that was that everything changed.
Well, how do you tie back your international tribunal and natural justice, where you're really trying to bring justice for people and you're trying to create an awakening there? How do you tie that back to what you believe your passion and your goals are now that you're at a different point?
Well, I'm not the one doing it. I mean, there's other people who are doing a lot more than I am to manifest the international tribunal. So let's be clear. Our registrar works 10 times harder than I do. Our chief justice and our court officers work 10 times harder. And some of our trustees do a great deal more than I do. I do what I can do, which is to guide the process and anchor the broad mission in some kind of an articulated narrative, which appeals and makes sense. And yes, I'm good at speaking with judges. I'm good at speaking with bishops. I'm good at speaking with ministers and presidents and celebrities and luminaries and academics. And I'm good at that stuff because I'm able to legitimately empathize and resonate with whoever's in front of me. I've learned that craft over many years. And I'll say this, I've learned to love whoever is in front of me, no matter how awful they may be. I will still love them. I may be, my actions may be harsh and my manner may be harsh, but what's actually there is never hatred or, you know, acrimony ever, or malevolence. I can't feel that, or jealousy, or any of that stuff.
Can you feel that with somebody that you know is sodomizing a baby?
I've not ever been in a conversation with somebody who I've known to be sodomizing a baby. If I was, I have been in conversations with murderers on a couple of occasions, people who have killed and done so in a ritualistic fashion. And on one occasion that comes to mind right now, I remember the individual when I them confessing what had happened many years before, I was horrified. And I did work with that individual on a number of occasions, and I tried to get that individual to really go down deep and dredge that up. But it was about 14, 15 years ago, and I didn't have the same expertise or wisdom flame that I have now. And I don't think I did a very good job. I think I turned that person to face themselves far too fast, and it didn't work out well. They ended up recoiling and disappeared, never heard from them again. So much for my counseling. I think, and that's one of the things that taught me, each man in his own way, in his own time, and the imperative of not judging another, never judging, even a pedophile or a murderer. It's not about judging or judgment, because my judgment is too visceral, it's too identified. There are far other, I mean, there are other methods of bringing justice to bear. So I'm not talking about judging in the normal judicial sense. That, of course, is a very needful and necessary protocol or system of flushing out stuff in the social construct. But I'm talking about me harboring judgment about you or about anyone else. This is always wrong action to judge. The one thing I do actually agree with in the Holy Bible is thou shalt not judge ever.
But that's different than stopping people from doing evil and stopping and doing that as fast and as serious as you can, right?
Yeah.
There's a difference.
You know, I was just in Thailand with Steven Seagal, for the last week and a half, and making a film with him, part of this film with him. And he's a remarkable guy, very different from the kind of brutish action hero that you see. Very intelligent, very sensitive, very, very humorous, a very witty guy, but incredibly humane and considered. And the business of human trafficking and anything that offends or injures children has been his big thing. So he is a commissioner on the International Tribunal's Judicial Commission of Inquiry. He's been commissioned and he's accepted the commission, and the world will know about that soon enough, believe you me. But I can't speak to, he is an enforcer. He used to be an enforcer before he was an action hero. He was in law enforcement, and he's never been able to lose that, that proclivity to want to enforce justice. Some people are born to that role and are fearless in the pursuit of that. I'm not someone, I will always jump into a fight. I'll stop my car and get out of my car and in order to jump into a fight. I have that reflex, but I don't look for a fight for sure. And I'm not, by nature, I'm not going out looking to be a hero. This is not my thing. Speaking truth, identifying truth and anchoring truth is something I've become very expert at. I've become so good at it, in fact, that many people demonize me for being the opposite. And that only speaks to the fact that I'm so bloody good at anchoring that. It becomes very confusing to those who aren't anchoring truth. They begin to see a false reflection. But speaking truth is what I'm choosing to do. The enforcement side of it becomes a whole different game. And if we wanted to speak about how a judicial commission or even a prosecution that takes place, for instance, in the International Tribunal, how does that end up enforcing something? That's a different conversation, and I could engage that conversation, but it's a complex one.
Okay. Maybe we'll have you back to talk about it, because there's a difference between not judging and being a pacifist that doesn't do anything, right? And that's not what we're talking about here.
So again, as I said earlier, when you place your attention on something and your inquiry is rooted in noble expression and you are seeking only pure truth, then you are by definition enlightening that subject. And that is a dynamic action that emancipates, doesn't judge it, it sees it for what it is, and it infuses it with light and begins thereby to trigger a transmutative and transcendental process. And that is how we help one another. That is how why empathy is so powerful.
And they might not like it, right? No. They might not like what they're being subjected to, because we've got to...
There's no may about it. They hate it.
Yeah.
No one wants to be exposed, especially if they're hiding in the undergrowth. No one wants to be exposed. But you see, that's the power of the absence of judgment, but the application of attention.
Yes.
Because that attention exposes it, enlightens it. The judgment simply declares war against it, and you have a dialectic that goes on, a ping pong. It becomes another binarized action which has no outcome. Big difference.
So when is this movie that you did with Steven Seagal going to be coming out? You talked about it a little bit, that it's going to take some time, but people are going to want to know, when is this thing coming out and when can I see it?
I'm honestly not going to give the answer to that, because I am bound not to give that answer. I'm sorry. But we're working on something. I was trying to allude earlier to the fact that it's taking some time. It will be released, but it is not entirely up to me as to when it gets released.
So sometime in the short future.
I think it's fair to say in the near to midterm.
Will you be promoting it as well, so they can keep an eye out for, you know, knowing that it's coming?
I won't need to promote it. When you hear when it is released and what is said in it, and it won't need promotion.
Really? Well, that's good.
It will sell. Well, it's blazing pure truth is what it is. Yeah.
Yeah, which is what we need. We need to get this stuff out there. So yes. What other projects are you working on, and where can people learn more about you and your projects and support you?
There's four organizations now. The primary one is Humanitad, a foundation. We are not soliciting donations. We don't accept them. I've been offered millions of dollars over the years. I don't accept money from anyone ever as donations in Humanitad. There are components of Humanitad that are incubating technologies, another one incubating medical and scientific innovations, and they have foundational trust structures which can receive support if anyone wants to get involved in developing of those innovations and technologies. But that's nothing to do with the core construct of Humanitad.
Well,
And
I definitely, not to interrupt you, I definitely need you back to talk about what you're doing there, but keep going.
yeah, and that's for me what is exciting. That's the real creative, proactive
I
stuff that is.
really want to talk to you about that. So we got to schedule a time for you to come back.
That's fine because that stuff's off the chart. But the other organization is New Earth. It's not an organization in that it's a universal trust that's been anchored to the sky and to the earth and to the people, and it's owned by the people of the earth, not by the Queen of England. So it hasn't been registered to England or United States. So it's not part of any fiction. It's a trust, and it cites the people of the world and all. And the land as being the beneficiaries essentially of that trust. So the New Earth Nation, also known as the New Earth Project, is an ongoing, unfolding planetary social experiment, which brings sovereign people from all nations and faiths together to emerge ultimately as a unified force for change, but standing in truth and standing in sovereignty and not being indentured into government structures and into registration processes and into ownership. And people who are stupid look at New Earth Nation and say, oh, that's just a front for Agenda 21 or for some United Nations thing. Yeah, well, if you look at it through, a mono glass, you're going to see something very reduced. But it's a very beautiful initiative. It's very frustrating because it's all things to all people and all comers, and we do a lot of it comes with a lot of luggage, that initiative, because it's volunteer-based. In simple terms, we've had almost 800 people come and join the administration and leave since July of 2013.
Oh, fun.
So
But it's
go.
hard. You're doing something difficult.
Very difficult, and it's not so much me, but the trustees and the direct project directors or management of New Earth have put up with so much and continue to, but it's such a beautiful family. And what we're manifesting is out there for the world to see. There's magazines that are coming out constantly. We're manifesting New Earth Havens, which are some of those beautiful places you'll ever see in your life. The one in Bali is a huge success in that sense. But again, it's a social experiment. So there's a constant clashes going on and egoism going on. It's not like some utopian, form has emerged yet, but the intention that is anchored by the founders of the New Earth Project is unruffled and doesn't move. So it's a beautiful thing to witness. There's about a dozen websites that people can go to, our university, the press, the media, media room. There's countless things on film that we put out. So that's the New Earth Nation side of things. And then there's the energy corporation, the QTPI, which we recently announced and did a soft demonstration of in Asia. And in the next week or two, another film is coming, short film is coming out, explaining more about the application of that quote unquote free energy technology. But yes, we're taking that to market in different parts of the world. We've spent 2 years doing the diplomatic work and negotiating that into certain industry sectors and into certain developing nations and small island states. So it's off the radar of the big bullies, and we have no intention of going head to head with them. Not that we're afraid of doing so, just we can't be bothered to. We're far too busy seeding in poor parts of the world that don't matter to the Babylonian business plan, but matter a great deal to human beings. So it's a perfect situation. And the other project or initiative is called Immortalis, and that is what is incubating now, the breakthrough medical innovations and bundling these technologies and innovations together in furtherance of reversing entropy in human health and wellness.
Well, I definitely need to talk to you about the high tech, the medical, all those advances you're doing. How are you funding your work if you don't take any kind of donations?
We don't. It's not about money. It never was about money. So I'm privately financed. I have my own business stuff, but it has nothing to do with my foundation work, nothing to do with Humanitat. And I've always had stuff that I do and create to pay the bills. But that's all we do. We're not rich. The assets, I think, are probably worth billions of dollars by now in intellectual assets. In fact, I'm certain of that. And I think in the next calendar year, we're going to be forced into the commercial marketplace, because that's what's happening right now with some of the technologies and innovations. And that's going to become a different game. But it has not been about money. And I've said this so many times, it is about the application of art and of beauty and of consciousness. So for instance, if you got on a plane and went to Bali and you were to see what we built there, well, I master architected it, and with Juan, who's our bioarchitect, and he and I worked for years together living there and conceived and then designed every inch of this place and built it. I am an architect. I went to an art academy and I did architecture years and years and years ago. So I've got that in my arsenal. And I was also a sculptor and a painter for some time. That was my passion before poetry. So application of art in that place has created a very beautiful place. And I have a lot of creative people around who have contributed to that. So people walk into it and go, oh my God, this is just like off the chart, exquisite, beautiful, expensive. And it wasn't expensive. It was built out of adobe, mud, and bamboo, but it looks as though millions and millions and millions of dollars were spent on it. So you see again, and it's a perfect litmus for people, because I'm saying, hello, we've been talking about the application of art, beauty, and consciousness as the true value. Here is a living example of it. And you are still caught up in false light, believing that it's all about the money, and it's not. Yes. We're living on credit cards still.
So do you grow your own food? Is it all an ecosystem so that you don't have to buy food, or how does that work?
We started growing our own food, but the farm ditched a few months ago. It was very, very badly managed, essentially, unfortunately. So we're not at this stage, but we're ensuring that everything's organic, and we are regrouping now to begin a farm again and to begin that. But we're making everything that we can possibly make. Mm-hmm. And I will state with a degree of confidence that within 2 years from now, we will be making pretty much 98% of everything that you find inside that particular haven, up to and including light bulbs.
Wow. So you're really self-contained, and then I didn't talk to him. Michael Tillinger, I listened to him talk about an environment, a city or a thing like what you're doing, a village that doesn't have money, and that how you trade your work and everything you're doing. Is that the concept of that?
Well, it is. I mean, Mike and I intersect on many. In fact, Mike was at the festival. He was one of our keynote speakers and came and stayed up for over a week, which is delightful. He's a very dear friend. And yes, a world beyond money is absolutely, I speak about a world beyond time, money, and fear. But the Ubuntu contributionism movement that Michael founded is absolutely demonstrating the mechanics, or exemplifying and promoting the mechanics of a contribution-based society. So we're both coming at the same equation from different perspectives. My emphasis with New Earth is on the dynamic application of art and of consciousness in order to manifest beauty. And that beauty is something which then creates a richness to it, because it becomes a light as opposed to a false light value, like a city or a, you know, a Hollywood film, which draws false energy toward it, something that is imbued with true beauty and true application of consciousness becomes a magnet for the same value and the same resonance. And that's what starts to create community. And it's not without its problems. I mean, right now in the Bali haven and the little community, there's a big hate campaign against me going on right now.
Oh, great.
Oh, yeah. Many of the Yoga Shmoga Brigade who are enjoying sex, drugs, and rock and roll, which I gave up many years ago, have been using the haven for expressing their idiom. And that's not congruent with the New Earth core values. So myself and the New Earth team have had to kind of flush out that element of the local community. And we're restoring now the founding values. It's not to say it wasn't a valuable experience going through this slightly hedonistic expression or allowing it to do its thing. It's just it was going in the wrong direction. It was becoming very festivity and party and ecstatic dance oriented. And I wasn't seeing a lot of real yoga come out of it, or a lot of, you know, application of good breathing techniques, or a lot of, you know, so just reset, reset, reset. And that, again, is part of a social experiment. There has to be an element which anchors the integrity of mission and then is able to step back in and go, I'm not saying I'm the one, but I certainly do anchor that. But all of the New Earth management do by now. We've become so well known to each other. And we step in from time to time and have to recalibrate something, reset it. And that's, it's ongoing. It's unlikely to end. For the foreseeable future.
Well, do you have people coming and just wanting to study it and understand it and are interested with it?
Yes. All the people I've spoken have been either in tears, literally fully grown men crying. I've had that now, I think, 5 or 6 times in the last year. Literally, fully grown men embracing me, crying when they met me and putting their arms around me and sobbing and saying, I never knew this existed. And I've spoken to, I can safely say, thousands of people over the last year, one way or the other, conversations, messages, interactions. And I've had I'd say 99% or 99.9% adulation at the New Earth and praise at what we're doing. And a couple of naysayers or detractors. But
you're always going to have that, right?
Yeah, you're always going to have that. You're always going to have it for sure.
When you're trying to change paradigms. Well, go ahead.
Something must be working in what we're doing, because you don't get that kind of visceral response from fully grown humans who are good souls. And we have a lot of people there going there now because they've heard about it, going to see it. And yeah, all the feedback I personally get is beautiful, very enchanting.
Well, you're doing amazing work. So I have to have you back. I'm going to get something scheduled to talk about some of these things you're doing. But thank you so much for joining me in this program. It's really interesting. And I love the work that you're doing. It's really important.
Thank you, Sarah. And I'm very, very grateful that you drew attention to the ITNJ and the other work that we're doing. Thank you so much.
Okay, have a great weekend.
Bye-bye now.
And that's all we have for interview today. But I want to remind you that I have a book out there called The Wrong Side of History, The Truth About Syria. It's on sale for $4.99. My paperback version is going to be coming out real soon too, so you can get your hands on that. Just recommend you to share the information. You can hear the video of it or the interview of Senator Richard Black that I did, or you can buy the book. I also include in the book the letter that he wrote to Assad. And the interview talks about his visit to go meet Assad last year in 2016, in his own words, why he wrote the letter. But he also talks about the fact that the whole region will be ethnically cleansed if Assad falls. We're talking about over 4 million people will be slaughtered if Assad falls in that region, it will be a mass catastrophe. It will be like our Holocaust, and we funded it, paid for it, and helped it happen. So I recommend that you read that or you share that, listen to the video, whatever you can do. Go to sarahwestall.com and you can get that information. So for now, I hope everybody has an amazing day.